You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The Alberta tar sands have been considered the world's dirtiest oil source. The vast majority of oil from the tar sands goes south to the United States. This may change if the Northern Gateway Pipeline project to the Pacific Coast is approved by the federal government. It would allow a large oil tanker export operation from Kitimat to Asia. Communities on the coast and along the proposed route of the pipeline have been raising concern over the project. Joining us in the studio to discuss the local implications of the pipeline is Josh Patterson. He's a staff lawyer with West Coast Environmental Law. Hello, Josh, and welcome back to Red Eye.
Thanks, Sean.
Now, at what stage is this proposed pipeline?
The proposed pipeline and tanker project is actually called the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipelines. Is at the early stages of the federal government's environmental assessment process. We're just on the cusp right now of the federal government releasing its final terms of reference, which will tell us exactly what this environmental assessment process is going to look at. And once that is done, the expectation would be that there would probably be 18 months to 2 years worth of hearings and process before a decision were made.
Okay. Now, can you tell us about the environmental and the economic concerns of the communities, first along the proposed pipeline route?
Sure. Well, there are a whole lot of concerns of communities along the pipeline route. These pipelines are going to be 1,170 kilometers long. They're going to be carrying tar sands crude oil from the tar sands to the coast, and really toxic condensate, which is something used to dilute tar sands oil for pipeline transport back from the coast to the tar sands. They're going to be crossing over 1,000 rivers and streams and going through the headwaters of the Fraser, the Skeena, and the Mackenzie River systems, which are, as I'm sure your listeners know, very important fish-bearing systems, some of the world's most important. And the toxic effects of a spill into any of these river systems would be completely devastating, not only for aquatic life, such as fish, but also the other life forms that rely on fish. It would be poisonous to the water and to groundwater. And oil spills into rivers are really impossible to clean up. And I should note that, you know, over the past few years, this company, Enbridge, has, in its own reports, had an average of about 67 oil spills per year from pipelines, despite what they say are their own best efforts. So, it really doesn't matter the technology that's involved. When oil moves, it spills. And we think that these rivers are really too critical to risk.
67. That's a large number.
It is. It is. And I think it's something that's quite alarming for communities along these river systems, both First Nations and non-First Nations communities alike.
Now, in addition to the communities along the pipeline, there's also communities on the coast. How will they be affected?
Well, I should back up for a moment and say that since 1972, there's actually been a moratorium, a federal moratorium on oil tankers traveling in those waters. So if you can imagine on a map, the waters basically from Vancouver Island going up to Alaska and from Haida Gwaii or the Queen Charlotte Islands to the shore. And six governments since that time have respected the moratorium. So we have been protecting the coast for all this time. And communities on the coast now are saying what we need is a legislated tanker ban, something that's in legislation that would stop the devastating effects of a tanker spill before they happen. I mean, if you think of the Exxon Valdez spill, 20 years later, the beaches there are still toxic, still have lots and lots of oil left in them. And in this part of the world, in northern British Columbia, there are marine mammals like orca whales, humpback, gray whales. There are over 600 salmon spawning and fish spawning rivers that come down to the coast. There are all of the animals and wildlife that rely on that ocean life. And of course, human communities really rely on the ocean too, whether it's First Nations communities who rely on the ocean for their sustenance, or whether it's ecotourism, the fishing industry. There are tens of thousands of jobs, billions of dollars of economic activity that depend on having a clean and healthy coast. And this project really puts that at risk.
And what are these communities doing to fight this proposal?
Well, there are just, I've had the privilege of traveling back and forth along the pipeline route and out to the coast in Kitimat and Prince Rupert. And I've been really inspired by the strength that I've seen in terms of people raising their voices about this project and raising their concerns. On the coast, there are numerous coastal First Nations like the Haida, the Haisla, the Gitgat at Hartley Bay, and others who have said in very clear terms that this is a project that they're not willing to entertain. They do not want, the Haida have said there's no way that they want these oil tankers in their waters. And if you go along the pipeline route and further into the interior, you just see packed community meetings with people coming out and being really, really concerned, both First Nations and non-First Nations.
Now we've mentioned this company, Enbridge. Mm-hmm. It's a large corporation. What are they doing to try to encourage or to get this proposal through?
A better question might be, what aren't they doing? They have a $100 million pot of money that's been given to them by 10 unnamed oil companies who, suppose would like to have the right to ship oil through this pipeline if it gets built. And they've been spending that $100 million to get themselves through the regulatory process. They've been sponsoring teams, sponsoring baseball tournaments, sponsoring cultural events, commercials, ads, you name it. They're trying to get this PR job done. And, what they're facing is really strong community opposition and really strong First Nations opposition. And, I think in spite of all of the resources that they have, that there's just been such an amazing strength of people speaking up and saying, both people saying that they don't want the project on the one hand, and then a lot of other people saying, we don't like the process that's being used to make the decision about this. We think that it needs to be significantly improved in order to make a really informed decision about whether or not this pipeline project and tankers are right for British Columbia.
Can you speak a little about that process? What is wrong with it exactly?
Sure. So the process that they've actually put together is called, it's called a review panel or a joint review panel. And to get a little bit technical, there's the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency. They conduct environmental assessments at the federal level, and the National Energy Board, who has responsibility over pipelines. They've come together and they're going to look at this and decide together as one body. And it's actually the best process that the federal government has to offer in its legislation. There are going to be hearings, there's going to be evidence, all this kind of stuff. What our concern is, and what the concern of many people that have been looking at it, is that it doesn't consider a lot of the big picture issues that need to be considered to make an informed decision. We can't really make an informed decision about a pipeline that has the potential to increase tar sands output without thinking about what will the climate change effects of that decision be? What will be the impacts in the tar sands in terms of environmental degradation, in terms of health effects on surrounding communities? The terms of reference as they're currently stated don't really take a good enough look, as far as we're concerned, at the effects of taking away that moratorium and deciding for the first time to have oil tankers on the coast. What are going to be the long-term implications of that decision for British Columbia and for Canada? The other thing, too, is that the process that's been proposed doesn't have the ability to really fully consider First Nations rights and title issues, which are protected in the Constitution. And with a project of this scale, First Nations rights and title are bound to be affected. There are over 40 First Nations who are, along the route and who stand to be directly affected. And the count goes up if you think of First Nations who are downriver and upriver of the pipeline route, who also could be affected. So there's some pretty big weaknesses there, and that's why we've been calling for a comprehensive public inquiry that will have the mandate to look at all of these questions. And I'm happy to say that over the summer and up to now, there have been a record number of people who've commented into Ottawa to say, we don't like this process, we want to see some changes. We're going to know in a few weeks how successful that's been and whether there will be changes that are substantive or whether there'll be changes that are kind of cosmetic and don't really take things into account. And we're just going to have to wait and see about that.
Now, this oil, as you mentioned before, is supposed to go to China and Korea and East Asia generally. And this large company, Enbridge, they've received financing, I understand, from Chinese and Korean companies. Is that right?
Well, we don't actually know who's put money into the pot. Enbridge a few weeks ago said that they were close to being able to announce firm commitments from companies who want to ship oil through the pipeline. We don't know who those commitments will be from. What we do know is that we know a few things. We know that this project isn't really needed. It's surplus to what the tar sands requirements are. With all of the pipelines that are already existing and are approved, they can go until 2019 or 2025 without having new capacity. So they don't need it. They're just trying to find a way of getting their oil around the United States and getting it out somewhere else. And we think that it's really too much to ask to put British Columbia's rivers and its coast at risk just so that there's another route for tar sands oil to get out of Canada.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the community resistance, local communities in northern BC. What can people who are, you know, living in Vancouver or other regions, what can they do to oppose this proposal?
Well, we're really actually fairly confident that if people speak up, they can make a difference on this. As I've said, there have been a lot of First Nations speaking up already. Enbridge has said it doesn't want to build a controversial project. So people across Canada are already getting involved, and they need to get more involved to say, we want to see a legislated tanker ban, because a legislated tanker ban ends the question once and for all and protects the coast permanently. So whether people are in southern British Columbia or across Canada, there are actions you can take, there are websites you can go to, like notankers.ca. They're the guys and women behind the tanker loonies. Lots of actions suggested there, lots of things that people can do. If you haven't gone to your MP's office, go talk to your MP. Just get out there and get involved, because this isn't just a northern BC fight. This is Canada's Pacific Coast, and it requires the attention of all Canadians.
Well, thanks, Josh, for coming in and informing us about this this project.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Josh Patterson. He's a staff lawyer with West Coast Environmental Law. If you would like to get involved, as our guest said, you can go to notankers.ca and sign the petition.